I'm gonna put it on.
Well, hey everybody and welcome. This is Dave. I'd like to keep the line open for discussion if you'll manage the background noise for the beginning. Thank you for your responses and the kind words and all the things you've sent in for helping me get an idea of what would be most helpful for us to include in the discussion. I need a mute of the background noise. If you're on a cell phone or a computer phone, if you would mute. I'm hearing myself. I agree with some of the things I say. If you're not ready to talk, please mute, star six. Are there questions or clarifications any of you have from our first seminar last week? Anything that might be helpful to talk about just briefly at the beginning of this seminar or other responses you have to the two questions I sent around? Anyone? Well, I hope that was useful to have an overview of just the concept. I'm going to put us on lecture mode because I hear some background noise. If we can get the background noise in some semblance of control, I'd like to preserve at the beginning and the end of each of our seminars and maybe the last seminar to add 10 or 15 minutes for discussion at the end after the top of the hour, just to be sure that we cover everything that would be of help and interest to talk about. Remember, last seminar we talked about the concept of story and how to develop that and how useful it may be for us as coaches to think about a client's story, because stories are how we perceive, how we remember, how we make sense of things. But remember that for the client, it's not a story, it's just the way things are. It's not a blind spot. It's not an inattentional blindness. It's not a belief. It's just the way things are. So those are our concepts to think about to help facilitate and catalyze a client's story. So we're going to look at now, in these remaining three seminars, a macro system of understanding a story and specifically apply it to a wellness story. The roadmap system. You have exercises and work tools to actually facilitate work on each of these steps of understanding really the algorithms that go into a story. And the kinds of patterns, whether it's behavioral or emotional or connection or other kinds of things that we do, how to really begin to understand that. The roadmap is one way to do that, a system to look at deconstructing a story, to look at what works and what may be facilitated to change or even develop a new system. So we're going to spend the remainder of our three seminars on looking at the roadmap system. In the first seminar, we're going to look at the first four steps. So, again, these seven steps are simply a deconstruction of the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. So, remember we talked about it, if you really want to address change or change a habit or create a new one, focus on the system. This is one way of doing this, a stepwise way of integrating psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching on a wellness story. Now, our focus is on wellness. It could be on life story, career, money story, relationship story, but look at the workbook that accompanies. Really, you don't need to look beyond the outline, because everything that we talk about, everything I'm talking about for each of the seminars, is in your outline for sort of ease of following, so you don't have to write things down. So the roadmap for a new wellness story, the acronym are these 7 steps: to recognize authorship, own your story, to assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map wellness strategies, author or create new experiences, and program new identity. This is an important step, and it's an important step for all of us as mentor coaches, because the most powerful force of the human psyche is our identity. We will always return to our identity. So unless that changes, unless that transforms along with the other changes that we make, for example, in behavior, if we don't also transform identity to incorporate that, we'll revert back to the old identity, and the change won't last. So each of these steps is simple, but it's not necessarily easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult, because it may change the way we think about our lives, to break bad or outdated habits, to develop new ones, to remain disciplined over the long haul. So the first 3 steps, recognize authorship, own your story, and assess the storylines, are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself or your clients. And just a sidebar here, I know I got a couple of notes about the assignment. Remember, the best way, in my view, to experience this would be to do the work tools and the exercises in the workbook yourself for each of the aspects that we're about to discuss in the next seminar. So let's look now at step 1, to recognize authorship of your wellness story. Now, remember the premise here. Each moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us, they're created by us. But yet, the story closest to us, our own, may be the most difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past and ending an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new, or at least revised, story. So how can we tell our life and wellness stories to ourselves in order to know what aspects work and which need to change? So there are 4 principles in recognizing authorship. First principle, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Here's a really simple example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a very small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg, stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope, relative to the baby elephant, is strong and it can't do it. The baby elephant then has to stay in the area determined by the length of rope. Now, fast forward, this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size. It could easily break the rope, same rope, but it doesn't, because earlier as a baby it couldn't. This 5 to 6 ton adult elephant is constrained by an assumption based on an earlier experience. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines the elephant's behavior. And this is also the beginning of recognizing that beliefs, just like facts and habits, are anatomical realities in the brain. You don't just present a better belief and expect it's going to override the one that's there. So we have to do that strategically. That's where we come into play. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle two, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, what we register, and how we process it. We construct our storylines from those premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. This is also part of what we do as mentor coaches, to highlight and collaboratively examine if certain beliefs or assumptions may be limiting to a client. And we don't get what we want, we get what we expect, because we always make our beliefs come true. And we also act in a way to teach people how to respond to us. This also further actualizes beliefs and validates assumptions. Principle three, a new story can only occur by being in the present moment. Social scientists have discovered that when you measure someone's intentions, you also can affect their behavior. When people are asked, for example, what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer, because they want to be consistent with how they've represented themselves. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 26%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates in the next 3 months by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, diet, or exercise. So, state your intentions. Be specific. Write them down. The stated intention is most powerful when it's coupled with a specific action plan. Principle four, our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. These research findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons that they do what they do, but when they're asked for a reason, they readily give one, because we decide at a midbrain level. We decide emotionally first and then move it to the prefrontal cortex to make it make sense and be logical and conscious. Neuroeconomists have even shown that we make purchase decisions up to 10 seconds before we're actually aware of what they are. And some neuroscientists have even said the primary function of the prefrontal cortex is to help make sense of decisions we've already made at a midbrain level. And then to create a complete story infers closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we may rationalize or justify or do any number of other kinds of mental gymnastics that bring closure, maybe without ownership or growth or even being the right cause and effect, sort of a finish without an ending. Now, I would suggest that you review the exercises in step one, recognize authorship of your story. It's on page 1.5 of the workbook. And look at the definition of plot and storylines. And look at completing the exercises in step one, if you haven't already, before moving into step two. Same with subsequent steps. Now let's look at step two, own your story. Here I'd suggest you review the assumptions and motivations constructing your storylines. This is page 1.7 in the workbook. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the million bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet, a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. Now, this is what we know now about how information doesn't work, how it can actually move someone in the other direction. Because when you give information, what we naturally do is compare it to what we already know, and then we begin to seek information that will validate our assumptions, or if it doesn't, ways to refute it. And in something called the boomerang effect, I've done a blog about this if you want to see just a bit more about it. In the boomerang effect, what's been shown is the smarter people are, the more they will respond to new information to discount it or refute it. Now, as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think may be helpful. And this is in your outline. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drive performance. So with any client, if there's an aspect of performance that may be compromised or that they don't like or that you see may be enhanced, look at the antecedent, at the behavior, because some behavior will go into that that may be addressed that could be improved. If a behavior is compromised, you may want to look at that antecedent, the belief that drives the behavior, because that's the software package that results in behavior, and the composite of that behavior is performance. For example, some empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to work out 6 days a week. Limiting beliefs can be just as powerful. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. I don't think my opinion's going to matter. Now, notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. So first you have to experience what you do as a choice rather than just the way things are. So a fundamental precept of step two, owning your story, whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that by talking about point of reference and active versus passive, two aspects of story writing. A point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories may have a premise, at times at least, of an external point of reference. They may transfer a responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They at times are likely to react to situations they're in. Now, I want to look at some examples because every one of these, every aspect of an external point of reference, to me is a coachable moment. To move that point of reference internal and make it something that someone sees that they're actively creating moment by moment. So here are some typical characteristics when someone has an external point of reference. So, and again, another way to say this, here's a list of coachable moments. They may feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They may feel vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They may focus on responding rather than creating. Well, you know, I have to do this. They may see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's the way I am. Or especially if they see a compilation of decisions called a habit as if it were an identity. Well, I stop because I'm a procrastinator. You hear how that does not explain anything, but at least somebody doesn't have to examine it further because they've diagnosed it. If they experience a symptom in their body, they may medicate it away. That's like turning off the warning light on the dash of your car. Now, those with an internal point of reference, this is what we coach toward, see their authority as their own. They realize it's not there until they create it. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility, so they experience an effectiveness. They know, at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. So here are some characteristics or examples. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they look at the chain of events that generated that result, but then especially look for challenges, opportunities, alternatives. And that's what we want to focus on to frame rather than understanding more about problems. If they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. And again, what's next? What's the possibility here? They decide what to change and initiate that change. And they also realize the menu of choices is also created because the menu is not there until they write it. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion. To recognize active versus passive positions. Because how someone constructs a sentence is going to tell you how they see themselves vis-a-vis their own authority. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. It just seems to keep happening. So these are each coachable moments because someone is presenting a fait accompli or a passive position as if their story is just happening to them rather than that they're the author of it. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So now once recognizing and owning your wellness story, step three, assess the storylines and the plot. One exercise that I ask a number of clients to do as they begin mentor coaching with me is the needs and ideals exercise that you see beginning page 1.12 in the workbook to distinguish and address ideals, distinguish and address needs. Needs and ideals are at the core of identity. It's part of the foundation of a sense of self. Ideals serve as a personal model of value, an internal guide to purpose, kind of like a true north. Living up to a personal, attainable ideal generates a sense of worth and esteem. It's the only place I know that self-esteem comes from having an internal ideal and living up to it. Failure to live up to an internal ideal results in a feeling of shame. And a need is an essential requirement. It's a necessity for mind, body, and spirit. Of all of the exercises and tools, these are the two that I will want a new client to do just to spend a few minutes. It only takes 10 or 12 minutes. As you do yours, it may be helpful to look at your top three needs and your top three ideals. For a new client, I put those inside the folder on the left-hand side so I can always look at those because they will be important as we look at strategies and goals to be sure that they align with needs and ideals so that all of someone is going in the same direction. There's a case vignette in that part of the workbook when about someone whose needs and ideals did not line up with their goals and strategies and created an impasse. So part of the assessment of a wellness story is to understand if there are conflicted or contradictory storylines. So when you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. And a paradigm, also called a mindset, is sort of a model. It's a theory or frame of reference, the way we see the world. And when we boot up a particular mindset, it's going to determine how we process the remainder of that engagement. With the right map, planning, and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but just assume that that's the way things are. And the brain has a mind of its own. We are of two or more minds. the prefrontal cortex, for example, says, well, let's set up an exercise program and plan a savings strategy. Now, the limbic system says, let's have that cheesecake and order the big screen HD TV. Each struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. Now, one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness. This is a primary aspect of what we help a client develop, the self-reflection and self-awareness that they begin to have more of an empathic appreciation of themselves, more of a reflection of how and what they think and feel and experience, to begin having that internal point of reference to plan that story in a more informed way. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things, reflect on them, examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. So in your wellness story, is all of you going in the same direction? Do all the storylines of your wellness story advance the plot? Another aspect, listen to your self-statements. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you may attribute to others, another person, a group, or culture, comes from inside you as your self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you may consistently like or dislike in another, and don't project your intentions or your solutions onto someone else's behavior. Listen for repetitions of the old story. This is a prerequisite to assessing changes. Remember, whatever remains unconscious will likely be attributed to fate. And we're always reaching our goals. It's just helpful to know consciously what they are. One example. If you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self. Not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape, or something unattainable. Well, I'd like to have the body of fill in the blank, or my body from 25 years ago. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. Then create an informed plan to get there. Now, we'll talk more about the art and science of how to structure a visualization. And there's also a visualization exercise in the addendum. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying builds in and out. That immediately says there's not a full commitment, a potential diversion to other alternatives. And you know the words of somebody not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in the takeaway. This is why when at the end of the mentor coaching session with your client, when you ask your client to summarize in a sentence what they are most importantly taking away from that session, and then what do they commit to do, if they begin with, I'll try, I need to, I should, anything other than I will, ask them for the commitment. Will you do that and commit to yourself to do that? And you know when somebody says, I'm going to try to quit drinking. You know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. And then build in accountability by asking yourself or your client, by when? Our SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end. Listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, when you work out and rest well, at the time, and especially later. A huge, delicious dessert will taste great at the moment, but the residual feeling and awareness of regret will last far longer in time than the immediate pleasure of the great taste. and reflect on what studies, but mostly your experience, shows. The major taste impact, up to 80%, is in the first three bites anyhow. So look at not just the first order consequences, the pain or the pleasure, or even the second order consequences, the outcome of your choice point, your decision-making of the first order, but also the third order consequences. The third order has to do with the long-term impact, the health, the longevity, the energy. Listen to your body, acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works and what doesn't. Hear your body speak when you eat too much. Eat foods that are unhealthy or drink too much. It's not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, and it's immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. Symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. A symptom is a sentinel of a process that needs, begs to be understood, listened to rather than silenced, respected rather than disregarded. It's a storyline needing to be heard. A symptom repeats until it's translated. It speaks more loudly, increasingly, until you listen to it. Somatic language can be very literal. A pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. A psychological symptom answers a question not asked consciously. I got that from X-Files. But I'm sticking to it, and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meanings. It's easier to fall. This is from Milrad Pavic. It's a very succinct summary. It's easier to fall ill than learn the truth. So take care of your maladies. They always have something to tell you. Remember, you're the author, not the victim of your symptoms. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. Now, let's look at step four. Decide what to change. We're going to talk about change and how to go about it in a systematic way. Now, the reference for the first exercise of Module 2, four basic inquiries for storyline evaluation. This is something I think that will help you look at deciding what to change. That's workbook page 2.4. Also have handy the exercise, 15 reflections to understand your storyline. That's on workbook page 2.10. These exercises and work tools are just to kind of help crystallize awareness, to facilitate the process. It may give you an idea if you want to do more work in this regard, even use the client workbook in a licensed, specially certified way. It can give you an idea of how you may want to use the workbook with clients in a more systematic way. Now, a precept for this step, deciding what to change. Part of the struggle for people to embrace change is because the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, and we've discussed this before, many people don't make changes even when they know it's in their own best interest, when they have ample information. Now, it's important to remember, your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. As I mentioned, it's simply a choice that gets repeated. It's a collection of repetitions. And again, if you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. This helps to bring closure and end the dissonance, the discomfort of your decision by saying, well, I'm a procrastinator, or, well, I'm whatever. And it's as if that causal, as if that's causal. And then you stop the inquiry about what you really need to do or why you had a plan and stopped yourself short of doing it. People become the stories of who they think they are. Remember the principle from step two, just moments ago. In adulthood, you either create your reality or you agree to it. Now, for this, you have to recognize and own your wellness story. So let's look at what's involved in deciding to change, to author new experiences. Let's look first at how the brain opposes change. Hang in, because there are a number of these. Understanding each one, I believe, will be helpful in facilitating change in your clients. Not that you're going to teach or train this, but it will inform you of how to be a catalyst. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change, as we discussed last seminar. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to help change a personal or a business story. So let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this to facilitate success. And remember, when you feel with one side of the brain and think on the other, you need a map. Since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider 10 precepts, in my view, of how our brains work. Each of these, I believe, will help you in guiding someone to write a new wellness story. Now, the mechanisms are a little complex, but the principles are so simple, they almost seem elusive at times. One, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to change or modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. And activities that we've repeated that have become habits have become hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeating behavior, repeating habits, in order to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to use energy. We don't have to think about how to drive the same way to work each day. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is also very energy efficient because the brain's then freed up to do other things. The brain is amazingly adaptive. It's made routine behaviors energy efficient by creating hardwiring and growing new neurons for that purpose. That's the evolutionary process of our brains as well as the moment-by-moment hardwiring. When these habits are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia in the midbrain, where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted. It's uncomfortable. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this change, this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit. Who does this apply to? First, each of you. That includes me too. And every one of your clients. The brain, again, naturally resists change. To hardwire behavior saves energy. So it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary standpoint. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Ray Kurzweil said that. I heard him say this in a presentation. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. That's from his seminal book, The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. It's K-U-R-Z-D-W-E-I-L. Two, how the brain opposes change. Change creates dissonance. Couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to do and to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We do this by screening information based on our expectation, and then we're validated and we see it. In fact, when people don't see what they expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. This is an actual anatomical location in the brain, very close to the emotional center of the brain. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. Again, the brain is a pattern-seeking organ. When we see a pattern that doesn't fit with what we expect, it's like something's wrong. The difference between expectation and perceived actuality. It registers as something's not right. At times it can be abrupt and explicit. Remember maybe the experience of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator, thinking about something, getting a drink of milk, boom, to discover that it was a sip of orange juice. When this happens, neural firings disrupt expected flow and use brain energy. Or simply when something is different. That's why rubbernecking occurs when you're driving, because that's different. It sort of confronts the usual boredom. It's something different. We look at it. The good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished reward. So it also responds to mistakes. Now, this is terrific, but we have to remember to discern whether it's a mistake or an actual response and print out to change itself. This is where we come in as mentor coaches. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. This is how it opposes change too. If you have a pen, I want to tell you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Usual responses, maybe 3 and 6, maybe even multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs even 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third will follow. Extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty gave an example of this. He said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how the brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of some jokes, listing 2 things, then a 3rd non sequitur, set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict, envision the right things. 4 of how the brain opposes change. Behavioral reinforcements can actually backfire. Think of this example. You're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. So what do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. 1, threats work short time, but they draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. A simple way to say this is, again, we get what we focus on. If you focus on something negative, the brain will seek to bring it about. So it's not going to be the thing that works the best. We get what we focus on, not what we want. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Have you already heard enough to say, well, that's really not the way it works? Not so, says the brain also. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change, preserve the automatic pattern. It's there for a reason. It should be what works. 5, motivation is not essential. How many times have you heard someone in your CTA classes, for example, in a coach that got, well, I need to get motivated, where I need to get motivated to have a healthier diet. I need to get motivated to lose weight. You do not have to be motivated to do anything. You only need 2 things. I work with a number of pro athletes and actors. They're not motivated to go to the gym every day, but they do it because they know it's what they need to do in order to do what's next. You only need 2 things, a plan and to stick to it. So if someone you're working with has not done something, the first question is, what is your plan? What's the system you have in place? And then, how did you, at the moment of initiating that, decide not to do it? 6, emotions can change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear or any other emotion can shift someone into a different state of mind. Any emotional trigger can be state-changing. So if an emotion is triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt perhaps toward action away from creativity and assessing knowledge even. So one of the primary things that we want to do to optimize both brain functioning and performance is to help someone regulate a state of mind, to get grounded and centered and choose the optimum state for the task that they're about to do. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term can enhance learning. The time window, though, is up to about 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make perhaps bad, emotionally charged decisions, and the most important success strategy is regulation of states of mind and management of emotion to get grounded and centered and enter an optimum state that houses the entire practice of that performance or of the task that needs to be done, whether that's an artistic or an athletic or intellectual performance, or whether that's simply just to more effectively and quickly get to sleep each night. 8, how the brain opposes change. Closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place in one position get most entrenched because they've not had the need to flexibly do transformations, to look at things in different ways. This is our challenge as coaches, to open a closed system, to empathically challenge, to strategically perturbate a closed system. It may simply be to convert a period into a comma. What else do you think about? Or what's the challenge there? Now, these last 2 principles, I think, are absolutely huge for coaching. 9. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis, the making of new brain cells. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's what we do with our clients, co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bus, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And more recently, these findings have been replicated in non-invasive human studies, London taxicab drivers, medical students at the University of Hamburg. The number of cells in the hippocampus, the seat primarily of creativity and memory, are enhanced in these ways. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus goes the other direction with chronic stress. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, studies were done with stroke patients who will have, because of that stroke, a dysfunctional arm. Now, instead of the traditional remedy or intervention of putting that dysfunctional arm in a sling so they don't harm themselves, the good arm was put in the sling. So they're forced to use the bad arm to do things like feeding and dressing. After 10 days of therapy, the patients regained significant use of an arm that would otherwise have hung useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Now, here's another example. Not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert braille reader has a significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same with the brain area of the dominant hand of classical guitarist. Now, the good news then is we are not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed, new highways to new communities in our brains. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So here are a couple of exercises that I'd highlight to be sure you do. The personal feedback assessment in the workbook, page 2.5, it's an adaptation of the 360-degree feedback business tool designed to get external feedback. And the other, reflections to understand your story. This is designed for your reflection, your internal feedback. So I want to close, and we'll have just a bit of time for discussion questions. What neuroscience teaches us about change, and these are four principles to apply to your wellness story. Here's what neuroscience primarily teaches us about change. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information, what their radar is coded for. Existing knowledge, this is from the perspective of us as mentor coach, existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts. And the reason? It's simple. It can't happen any other way. We have to be where someone else is before we can go someplace new. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. And this is what I mentioned, every fact, every behavioral attachment and emotional pattern, every belief is an anatomical reality in the brain. Neuronal networks are a physical fact. They can't simply be removed or just overwritten by maybe a better fact. They do, though, atrophy with disuse as other networks take their place, but it's an inside job. And this is part of learning and of unlearning. Both of these are important. Three, if we ignore reality, it's going to get in the way of new information and change. This is why fixing doesn't work, or supplying an answer, or giving a multiple choice question. You can't just list the four reasons an idea is wrong or an idea that you have is better and expect it's going to suddenly rearrange somebody's neural network. This is why we go through the systematic approach that we're talking about, which is simply one way of doing it. Why the roadmap is a macro system to understand the algorithms of how we construct our stories and how we can craft change. And finally, four, partly because it's complex and personal, and partly because it's subjective reality, which is kind of saying the same thing, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. So here's an example of an attempt to change. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a coach. They went to an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmation. After a few hours, one penguin flew a short distance. Others were encouraged. They were so excited and saw them. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. So we're in conversation mode. Remember to manage background noise. Stay on mute until you're ready to talk, ask a question, or comment. I'm eager to hear from you. And please put on mute. Because otherwise I only hear my echo. Everyone on mute, star six.
Thank you.
Everyone on mute, or we're going to continue to hear an echo. I tell you what, send me any questions or thoughts you have in an email, and I will remember to be sure and encourage everyone to be on mute for this to work for a discussion. I'd like it to work. I'm very interested in a live exchange. Send me any questions or thoughts in an email.
Hello? Did.
Hello, are we still on?
Hello?
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 Is the class over?
Over?
Actually, it ended very suddenly.
Yeah.
And I was still waiting.
Yeah, I thought so too. I put it on mute and then I sent him an email, but I haven't heard a response yet.
No, that's why I stayed online, because mine was on mute and I was like, okay. Like, what is going on? Because it's just like, it sounded like a recording, and that's it.
You know, and you may be right about that. So my name is Arthur Jones. What's your name?
My name is Emmy.
Emmy. Yeah, I don't understand what's going on either, so. Well, Emmy, I'm going to go ahead and hang up, and hopefully he will respond to my email, because he was asking for people to mute, but I guess I just don't really know.
I'm unmuted too now, Arthur.
Oh, okay.
So and I put myself on mute.
So how did you unmute?
Yeah. It starts it.
But that's to mute it. How do you unmute it?
You just do it again. You just do star six again.
Oh, okay. See, I have a little mute button there. My wife has said, just press mute. So he's gone then, huh?
Yeah, the session is over. But there'll be a recording.
Okay. Thank you.
So you were, I have a question though. You were able to continue to hear it?
Well, I was able to hear him say, everybody put on mute, because he wanted to be interactive, that it was, you would get the, what do you call that? And then after that, it went blank.
Okay, so that happened to me too. I thought something was wrong.
I had the same experience.
It might have been just too much noise on it, and if he does a recording for presentation, he wants it to be pure so we can listen later. So that might have been what happened.
Okay. Well, you all enjoy the rest of your week.
You too.
Be safe.
Yeah, let's all do the assignment, okay? Let's learn from it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good mindset. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.